This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Former state treasurer Timothy Cahill has been indicted on public corruption and fraud charges stemming from his failed gubernatorial campaign in 2010.
We'll hear more about those charges announced this afternoon by Attorney General Martha Coakley later this hour.
But first, the case of Trayvon Martin and what it says about the risks facing all African-American males from Los Angeles to Boston.
Yesterday in Miami, thousands of people rallied on behalf of the unarmed black teenager who was shot dead by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch volunteer, this past February. Local police have not arrested Zimmerman, who claims he killed Martin in self-defense. But yesterday, political leaders, sports stars, and entertainers were among those calling for an arrest in the case.
The killing of Trayvon Martin has reignited a debate across the country about racial profiling. And it's raised difficult questions for the parents of young black men and boys. Chief among them is this: what should you tell your sons about this case? Is the lesson of Trayvon Martin that young African-American males need to be extra careful out there, particularly when confronted by authority figures, be they neighborhood watch members or police?
If staying alive is the most important outcome, is the best advice keep your hands visible, answer only yes, sir, or no, sir, accept these basic rules of deference, difficult as they may be to swallow, and survive? You can insist on your constitutional rights later. So this is the question we're going to explore right now: how to talk to your kids about the Trayvon Martin case. And joining us now are two guests who know a lot about this issue. They've lived it, thought a lot about it, and we're happy to have them with us. Willie Davis is a criminal defense attorney and partner with Davis, Robinson, and Malloy in Boston. And Willie Davis, thanks for coming in. It's a great pleasure to have you.
My pleasure.
Also with us is Mac D'Alessandro. He's a principal at Democracy Partners. He lives in Milton and joins us today by phone from Washington, D.C. And welcome to Radio Boston, Mac D'Alessandro. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Willie Davis, let me start with you. My understanding, we were just chatting before we went on the air, is that for a long time you've preached that when faced with a police stop, and let's talk about a police stop, there's one way to respond, and that's with complete cooperation and deference.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's been my experience that if a police officer stops you, there must be a reason. Now, we don't know what that reason is. It could be a legitimate reason, or it could be just a whim. I don't know. But the safest thing to do is to be, if you will, subservient. Mm-hmm. You know, take whatever the police officer says and respond courteously. I don't even know if you have to go so far as say yes, sir, but use yes very nicely.
Mm-hmm. And what if there is a feeling that the stop is inappropriate, or there's a sort of obvious sense that you've been sort of swept up in some kind of almost dragnet because of the color of your skin?
Well, that's a battle you can fight later. You cannot fight that battle in the street because it's a battle you cannot win. You simply cannot win it.
And you can't win it. And a moment ago, you used the word the safest thing to do, because the consequences here can be very, very serious.
Absolutely. First of all, you should point out that we don't know what the police officer knows in the first place. What information does he have? Is he acting on information, or is he acting just because he sees a black person out there and he wants to do something about it? I don't know. But you have to assume that he has a reason. There is a way to take him on, but out there in the street is not the place.
Mac D'Alessandro, you wrote a very interesting, compelling piece in the Boston Globe recently about your experience as a child of being picked up by police in connection with a crime you didn't commit. And I'm wondering if we could just start there and then talk about your thinking in light of that story.
Yeah, I was a 12-year-old kid. Waiting for a school bus, as millions of kids do every day. On that particular day, I was picked up not by the bus, but by a Chicago police officer, and taken to a crime scene where a woman had clearly been violently assaulted. The entire time, I was grabbed by my hair in front of my house and put in the back of the car and taken to this crime scene, pulled out of the car by my hair. And asked the officer asked the woman who'd been assaulted if I was the one, and she said no, I wasn't, through her sobs. And even once I'd been exonerated by the victim, I was grabbed again by my hair and put back in that car and taken home as though nothing had happened.
Now, just Mac, to be clear to our listeners, I understand you're adopted, your parents are white, you're black, and you write that your parents gave you advice for these kinds of encounters. What did they tell you?
They gave the advice that that Mr. Davis just did, which is your first order of business out there on the street when dealing with anybody, but law enforcement is to be safe. And being safe was being deferential. It's because that was the way to minimize the risk that something bad would happen.
Yeah. And what's your feeling about that now after many years of sort of embracing that, of being brought up with that idea? You write in the Globe that this deference, this sort of yes, sir attitude has a cost over time.
Yeah, well, it comes at a great psychological and emotional cost because we're raised, or I was raised, to know the difference between right and wrong, and that if you did something wrong, there'd be consequences. But as I've learned throughout my life, not just when I was 12, but when I was in college and also in law school, sometimes even when you do things right, there are consequences that that aren't always good.
But is that to say that you would advocate something different? I mean, you have a son, for example. Would you tell him something different than what Willie Davis just said?
No, and unfortunately, in a rather cruel twist of fate played on me by the genetic pool, my son actually looks kind of Scandinavian. So I don't know that he's going to have to worry about this to
sure.
the extent that I did. But as a parent now, I will say that my experience has created a little bit of fear in the back of my mind that one day my son will have to see his father.
Yeah.
Treated to yet another injustice.
Sure. And so what do you come away with when you look at what happened down there in Florida? And of course, there's a lot of facts we don't know about what happened with the Trayvon Martin case. But, this piece you wrote in the Globe was prompted by that. I'm just wondering, what do you take away from that case?
Well, I think I will always be deferential to law enforcement, just, again, to be safe. I want to be a husband to my wife, and I want to be a father to my kids, so I want to be safe. The point of the piece I wrote in the Globe was that, do I have to now exhibit this kind of deference to fellow citizens on the street that don't think I belong in a certain neighborhood or on a certain street? I don't know if that's a price I can pay.
Mm. When you say certain citizens, in the case of the Trayvon Martin case, we're talking about a neighborhood watch person.
So in other words,
to fellow citizens who might be armed. Well, let me ask the question to Willie Davis. We live in a world now where neighborhood watch groups, especially in states that have stand your ground legislation, might be putting black teenagers at risk. Do they have to be aware of those risks and accord them the same kind of deference that you were describing to police officers?
That's a very difficult question to ask and to answer, because I simply do not know.
Right.
I have been taught to respect authority, but what is the authority here of this neighborhood watch guy? And there is a question that's been lingering in my mind since this thing occurred. And, of course, I don't know what happened. I don't have very much information, but I'm told that Trayvon Martin was very close to his house when he was shot. And if that is so, and if the neighborhood watch guy was in that same neighborhood, protecting, if you will, that same neighborhood, what are the chances that he did not know that this kid was, in fact, in the neighborhood, lived in the neighborhood? Those are questions that I don't have the answers to, but it does come up in my mind that if he was a neighborhood watch guy and he's looking out for the neighborhood, is he looking out for the neighborhood of certain people or just the entire neighborhood? And if so, why didn't he know that Martin was one of his neighbors?
Mm. Mac D'Alessandro, do you want to take that on?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I mean, I think this situation has caused a lot of people to ask a lot of questions and a lot of tough questions. I can really only speak from my experience and what I feel about this.
Yep.
And I just don't know that I can swallow being confronted by somebody who's not a member of law enforcement who wonders what I'm doing walking down a street.
Listeners, we're talking about surviving while black in America. What advice should parents give to their black teenage boys to keep them safe? Is the lesson of the Trayvon Martin case that kids need to be extra deferential to authority figures? And if so, does that come with a cost? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Mac D'Alessandro, I want to ask you this. One of the things that seems so troubling and sort of jarring about the Trayvon Martin case is, you know, we live in this America where there's conversation about a post-racial society. We have a black president. And yet something like this happens and reignites these long-running debates about things like racial profiling. And it seems like we almost have to hold two thoughts in our consciousness simultaneously. And I'm just wondering how you make sense of that.
Yeah, well, it's tough to make sense of it because on the one hand, yes, our president, we have a black president, and that's a sign of tremendous progress. And there are other tremendous signs of progress in the way we deal with one another in this country.
Yep.
But then there are, you know, as this Trayvon Martin situation has surfaced, there remain very troubling aspects about the way we approach and view one another and interact with one another.
Let me introduce Francie Latour. She's a contributor to the Boston Globe, and she blogs about race for Boston.com's The Hyphenated Life and at Caramels on Maple Street, which chronicles her experience raising a biracial kids in small-town New England. And she joins us now from her home in Sherburn. Francie Latour, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Love to get your reaction to what you've heard, lessons from the Trayvon Martin case and this whole discussion about the importance of deferring to authority, but at what cost?
Right, right. Well, you know, one of the things that's happened, I think, with the polarization of this case on racial lines is that, you know, that so much of the focus has been on the outrage, and rightly so. But among, you know, black parents and certainly, you know, black mommy bloggers and parent bloggers, there's just a real fear that I think has been a little bit obscured. I think a lot of parents are just kind of terror-stricken, and particularly because of the circumstances of this case, black parents who are living in predominantly white, you know, suburban or, as in my case, you know, semi-rural environments, it's a very, very scary time. And so, you know, I'm on all these email lists of, you know, where emails are being circulated about, these are reminders of what to tell your kids to do along the lines of what Willie and Mac have been describing that they do when they are confronted by police. So, yeah, there's a lot of conversation. There's a lot of hand-wringing. There's a lot of anxiety and fear.
And quite understandably so. Yeah. Willie Davis, you were addressing the Jack and Jill Foundation last week. I think the Boston, the Newton chapters. You must have heard from parents out there. What did you hear? Did you hear concerns along the lines that Francie Latour is talking about?
Of course. But I think what I heard more than anything else was agreement with the position that I was taking, and I was glad to hear that. In other words, the parents are more concerned about their kids surviving, and to do that in the event they are approached by law enforcement personnel, tell them how to act. Now, this Trey Martin situation is entirely different because we're not dealing with a police officer. We're dealing with a civilian, and quite frankly, that's very troubling, you know. Under what authority did this person act? And, of course, did Trayvon Martin know that this was person speaking with authority? What would he have done? If he did anything, would it have been different? I don't know. This is it's a very troubling situation, and that's one of the reasons why I'm glad that we don't have that here.
Well, let's take a couple of calls. Listeners, you can join this conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Barbara, who's calling from Nashua. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My only comment is that I think all people, white, black, purple, green, whatever, need to be deferential to authority figures, and that it is a problem in this country that respect for authority is on the decline.
All right, Barbara, we take that point aboard. Glad you called. Mac D'Alessandro, there's Barbara in Nashua saying respect. Everyone ought to respect authority figures, but I think there's something different at stake if you're a person of color.
Yeah, I think about the number of times in my life that, and I've never committed a crime in my life. Mm. And I will admit to your listeners that I've got a couple of speeding tickets here and there, but I'm not a criminal. Mm-hmm. And I, to have been stopped and forced to have my hands on a squad car and asked where I'm going and what I'm doing, and to be handcuffed for having done nothing wrong. And again, I've never done anything but say yes, sir, in those situations. My only point was is that that does take a toll.
Yeah.
on somebody's psyche, on their soul, over time.
Willie Davis, I want to ask you to comment about what Mac just talked about, because I think everybody agrees with the point that you make. But what about this point that this does take a toll? I don't think anyone would say, take a chance and tell the cops what you think and risk getting into serious trouble. But what do you say to that issue in terms of it taking a toll?
I would simply say try to hold on. Hold your temper and move on. And I would imagine that quite often when people do respond in a negative way, that perhaps that is the ultimate, that is the builder. Perhaps they've been stopped so many times and they say, oh, I'm not taking this anymore. Well, that's understandable, but hopefully, you'll be able to suck it up at least one more time. And then perhaps you can do something about it later on. I mean, there's always the avenue of filing a complaint if you feel that you have been treated wrongly out there, even though you weren't arrested. But the way you were handled, I was concerned here as I listened to Mike describe what happened to him, grabbed by the hair. Wow, I think that type of a situation would put somebody almost on edge. So at the next time or the next time or the next time they were stopped, they may have reached that boiling point where they could take no more.
Hmm. Francie, talk to us a little bit about the difficulty, the challenge of being a parent, of teaching children about the world we say we live in and the world we actually live in.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to just say about the caller's comment too. Before I answer that, I think there is people may not take into account sort of there's respect for authority, but there's also you have to look at the origins of the initial encounter. And I think living in a small town myself, I can say in Trayvon's case, there's a certain sense in which just being black in a white environment kind of demands an explanation. And so before you even get to the question of, well, how does a person interact with law enforcement, you kind of have to examine, why is it that a person of color would be stopped in the first place? And I don't think a lot of people necessarily see that. But yes, in terms of teaching kids, my oldest is 7, so this is a conversation I haven't had yet, and I think like a lot of parents of young black boys kind of dread having, and there is going to come a time when it has to be had. I don't really know at what age, but I appreciate so much what Mac talked about, his son seeing him treated in a certain way, and also, like his son, my son is biracial, and so he can look Guatemalan one day and he can look, different another day. So I think it really depends on what kind of situation that you're in.
Sure. Let's take a couple of calls now. Mason is calling from Worcester. Hi, Mason.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment. I think we're framing this conversation in terms of deference, and to me that's just, it's a very subtle but it's also a very troubling word. I really wish that we could, progress to the point where we get to civility and having everyone treat authority figures with civility, like Mr. Davis was speaking of, you know, be civil first and pursue recourse later. But to expect anyone of any color to defer, I know it's just, it's troubling to me, and I wish that we were further along in our race relations in this country. That's really all I had to say.
All right, Mason, we appreciate the call, and I'm sure there's a lot of agreement around this table to what you just said. Let's go to Gypsy, who's calling from Beverly. Hi, Gypsy. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I just had an observation that I wanted to make, and that is I'm a white-complected person, and so I'm aware that I navigate this world with white skin privilege. I have a younger sister who's African-American, and growing up in the 70s and 80s, I was aware that, quite frankly, I live in a different world than her, even in the same house, in the same world, because of the privilege that's been afforded to me. And when she had my nephew 19 years ago, we were terrified of what he was going to go through being born at kind of the time the Rodney King trials were happening and the OJ trial. And seeing what's happened these last few weeks with what happened with Trayvon Martin has me just horror stricken to think that my nephew is living in this world where that is how he is judged. He is a black man walking through the world, and that he's in danger or potentially in danger all the time, and that so many white friends and family that I have don't see that, and this huge cultural amnesia exists where they refuse to accept that. And the first step, I really think, is for white America to stand up and say, we have white skin privilege, it is unearned entitlement, we accept that it's a truth, and instead of denying it, see how we can actively work to be allies for social change. Because until that happens, we're going to continue to see instances like this over and over and over.
All right, Gypsy, we got it. Thanks so much for your call. Mac D'Alessandro, picking up on Gypsy's point, I mean, where is the work that has to be done in your view? I mean, looking at this, I mean, for example, I'm thinking about the way general descriptions of suspects work. Just last week, for example, the Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker was stopped because he matched the description of an African-American male in his mid-40s. You know, African-American male, mid-40s, that's an incredibly broad description. I mean, do we need to work harder on the way these descriptions get laid down by law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one to which I don't know the answer. I don't know if it contributes to the way people are described, contributes to this profiling. In response to my piece, I guess what I saw was this tremendous response of people sharing their own experiences. White people, black people, young people, older people, and I'd like to hope that perhaps it's just in beginning to have or continuing or restarting the conversation on issues that, you know, tend to make us all a little uncomfortable to talk about.
Yep.
That perhaps we might start inching forward.
And Willie Davis, let me ask you the same question. You're a criminal defense attorney, so it occurs to me that you have a good sort of perspective on this. But this idea of these broad descriptions and the way suspects are often described, what's the remedy for that?
I don't think there is a remedy because everybody has to act. Let's say, for example, there's a robbery and you have a suspect described as a black male driving a Cadillac, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you see a black male driving down the highway in a Cadillac. Is it common sense for you as a police officer to stop him? And I can tell you that that's what happened to me. 2 o'clock in the morning, and what really concerned me was when I was pulled over. I sat there, as I should, with my hands on the wheel, waiting for the trooper to approach. Well, it took about 5 minutes for him to get there, and then I learned later that the reason why he was so long coming to me was that he had called for backup. In case he saw that I was a black man, and he called for backup. Now, I think that was prudent on his part, too, but after all, all the information they had was that a robbery, black male, in a Cadillac, and I fit the profile, if you will. Now, when he had backup arrived and they approached me, And I gave them my driver's license and registration, and they told me why they had stopped me.
And that seemed okay to you?
Well, I couldn't quarrel with that.
Sure.
Because he could have done something else. You know, he could have been a little more proactive, but I have to give them credit. All they had was a black male driving a Cadillac, and that's what they acted on. So I can't really quarrel with them about that.
Well, we won't quarrel with that. Obviously, some big issues and questions linger out there in the wake of Trevon Martin. Willie Davis, criminal defense attorney and partner with Davis, Robinson, and Malloy in Boston, thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it. And Mac D'Alessandro, he's a principal at Democracy Partners. He recently wrote an op-ed in the Boston Globe called No More Yes Sir. Mac D'Alessandro, thank you so much. We appreciate
it. Thanks for
having me. And Francie Latour is a contributor to the Boston Globe. She blogs about race for Boston.com's The Hyphenated Life. Francie Latour, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, the conversation continues on this subject at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Up next, the latest on the indictment of former Massachusetts treasurer and one-time candidate for governor Tim Cahill on public corruption charges. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.